Welcome to Movements, a broadcast where we look at stories in the news and connect them to Canada's colonial history, its democracy serving a diverse population, and its foreign affairs with a global north and global south analysis. It's a broadcast that talks about power, biases, and how all of us in the Eastern Townships can care about what's going on near and far. I'm Gabrielle, and let's dive right into what's been happening. Today, we are looking at news related to Canada's democracy and foreign affairs. Just a heads up, we do discuss protests in Iran and the Hockey Canada scandal that some listeners may find to be sensitive topics. In Iran, protests over the circumstances of the death of a 22-year-old woman, Mahsa Amini, have entered their fourth week. These protests have rocked the nation with one of the boldest challenges to the theocratic government since 2009, but they have come at a price. According to Oslo-based group Iran Human Rights, as of Wednesday, October 12th, at least 201 civilians have died in the protests, including 23 minors. A crackdown by the government on the crowds is the source of the violence, including the use of tear gas and live rounds. Amini was arrested on September 13th by Iran's Guidance Patrol, the Morality Police, for breaching the country's rules on properly wearing a hijab. The police told Amini's family that she had suffered a heart attack and brain seizure at the police station. She was transferred to a hospital just 2 hours after her arrest, spent 2 days in a coma, then died on the 16th. Amini's family said that she died from blows to the head and was healthy at the time of arrest. In Iran, large demonstrations occur every few days in reaction to her death, while smaller neighborhood protests occur on a daily basis. Cars passing by crowds honk to show their support. There have been widespread internet outages as the government attempts to stop the spread of information and protesters' ability to coordinate. But that has not stopped chants such as Woman, Life, Freedom. Or Death to the Dictator. Continuing. The protests notably span geographical location and class divides.
We're taking steps that will raise the bar internationally in holding Iran accountable.
That's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau at a press conference last Friday. He announced the most recent round of sanctions on Iran.
First, we will be pursuing a listing of the Iranian regime, including the IRGC leadership, under the most powerful provision of the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act.
These sanctions bar 10,000 officers and senior members of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and its leaders from entering Canada. It invests $76 million into Canada's ability to implement sanctions, as well as their ability to freeze and seize Iranian authorities' assets. Protests that took place across the world in solidarity with the women in Iran include demonstrations in Sherbrooke on September 25th and October 1st, where protesters gathered in front of Sherbrooke City Hall. According to Issy Astri from Radio Canada, the Iranian community in Sherbrooke is about 500 people strong, many of whom are students. The protests are a reaction to more than just the death of one woman. An article by the British Broadcasting Channel, released on Wednesday the 12th, is headlined, How Iran's Economic Woes Created Conditions Ripe for Protests. These conditions are in part driven by the effects of economic sanctions imposed by the US and EU, coupled with internal mismanagement and corruption. The existing sanctions in Iran today, initiated in 1979, are driven by U.S. responses to Iran's nuclear weapons program and the support of terrorist groups. The international community, including the UN Security Council at one point, and Canada currently, has followed suit with the US and EU in prohibiting certain economic relations with Iran that may allow them to develop their nuclear programs or threaten global security. The results, long before the most recent protests erupt in Iran, is a controversial humanitarian situation and a Iranian government with many grievances against the US and Western countries. More broadly, it's a situation where it's worthy to consider how large politically, economically, and militarily powerful countries have used their power to influence the development or governance of less resource-advantaged countries, whether that be related to global security, securing economic resources, or advancing the spread of democracy. It's worthy to ask whether, in the end, this has actually brought about ideal changes in such nations, or just more animosity and skepticism between the global North and the global South. Is this just imperialism continued? If the latter is the case, what would have been the alternative to harsh sanctions in Iran? The criticism surrounding sanctions is that its effects are felt predominantly by citizens, while leadership up top can remain rather unaffected. With sanctions limiting Iran's international transactions and other banking complications, there's a myriad of unintended economic problems in the country. Iran faces shortages of essential drugs and life-saving medicines that it is not able to supply through their domestic pharmaceutical industry nor with existing import channels. The unemployment rate amongst female university graduates currently stands at 22.3%. The rial, Iran's currency, has lost 90% of its value in the last decade. Inflation this year is hitting Canadians in many aspects of their lives, from food to oil to materials used in production, but this has been the norm in Iran for much longer. Prices of goods and services are more than 10 times higher than what they were 10 years ago. Inflation in Iran is projected to average 47% by March 2023. Canada's average rate for this year is 7%. The townships are far from Iran, but there are Canadian Iranians and Iranians among us facing unreliable communications with family back home, who want us to understand, as Nastaran Golchin, who led the protests in Sherbrooke, told the Sherbrooke Record, "We want Canadians and the government to support us and be our voice. I don't want people to just pay for us. We want to do something for Iran, for human rights and women's rights." Closer to home, the federal government and Australian mining company Rio Tinto have decided to invest a combined $737 million into a metal processing plant in Sorel-Tracy, Quebec, just over an hour and a half drive away from Sherbrooke. The investment will allow the potential for cleaner and increased production of minerals such as lithium, titanium, and scandium that are in demand for electric vehicles, among other uses. The investment project hopes to quadruple the plant's current production of scandium oxide, which is used to make lighter aluminum alloys, extending the range of electric vehicles, or EVs. If pilot projects are successful in extracting and refining titanium metal, the facility could become one of the largest titanium producers in North America. Additionally, last week, Rio Tinto started producing a mineral in the Sorel-Tracy facility that is used in the production of lithium for batteries. The irony of a low-carbon future is that it will be very mineral-intensive. That's the phrase the World Bank Group uses in a 2020 report. Though the demand for electric vehicles is mostly in the global north, the majority of the supply of these minerals and EV batteries come from the global south, as they do for other green technologies. When we refer to the global north and global south, these are the most recent and generally preferred terms among academics and international development organizations about the economic and social development of regions or groups of nations. They're similar to the more broadly recognized terms first world and third world countries, or developed countries and developing. But the names Global North and Global South attempts to use a more accurate and value-free language, given the realities that we no longer live in a Cold War era where the Second World was the USSR, and that in general, most of the world's poor are in the South. And now let's head back to where we were just at. The world's largest cobalt reserves are in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Over half of the world's lithium reserves are in Argentina, Bolivia, and Chile, known as the Lithium Triangle in Latin America. However, it's China who dominates the EV battery market because these minerals pass through and are processed there. The Quebec provincial government offers some of the most generous rebates across Canada for the purchase of new electric vehicles. Earlier this year, they also committed to electrifying 65% of Quebec's school bus fleet by 2030. It's a plan that has put additional pressure on the Eastern Township School Board as they deal with fuel costs and currently bus driver shortages. All new school buses purchased after November 2021 must be electric, and though the provincial government will provide a subsidy per bus, e-buses are still very costly. Canada's ability to source minerals at home could be crucial to meeting the growing demand for EVs, not just domestically, but in connected markets. It will be interesting to see whether progress at Sorel-Tracy and other mineral production facilities in Quebec will affect the prices of EVs and electric buses. Currently, one of the largest electric bus manufacturers in Quebec is Girardin, headquartered in Drummondville. Girardin is the exclusive distributor of their Bluebird electric buses and minibuses in Eastern Canada. In our daily lives, we may feel far removed from these large mineral production facilities, mines, and foreign investment projects overseas, but their outcomes are in the palms of our hands, smartphones, laptops, and in the transportation we use to get around. The places where minerals like lithium come from take on discussions that are familiar to Canada, about indigenous rights over their lands, proper consultations, and sustainable development. Where there is green technology in the townships, there will also have to be a supplier of its minerals. Finally, we are taking a brief look at what's happening with Hockey Canada. On Tuesday, October 11th, Hockey Canada's CEO and entire board of directors resigned. Their resignation comes in light of news that Hockey Canada used $7.6 million of their National Equity Fund to pay out multiple settlements for sexual misconduct cases since 1989. In federal government's leading cause for change is the Minister of Sport, Pascal Saint-Onge, who is the Member of Parliament for Brough-Missisquoi.
Please, on the sponsors pulling out of Hockey Canada and what comes next.
I think that it shows that Hockey Canada's leaders are losing support, that they no longer have support of their sponsors, of Canadian families that are sending their kids to play hockey, and they're also losing support from their own members. So I hope that they understand the message and leave before they burn it to the ground.
This was Saint-Onge on October 7th, days before the leadership of Hockey Canada did indeed step down. She's referring to major sponsors including Canadian Tire, Tim Hortons, and Scotiabank, who cut their sponsorships for the men's programs. Hockey Quebec, the provincial branch of Hockey Canada, has minor hockey associations throughout the townships, including Stanstead, Coaticook, Magog, Sherbrooke, and Granby, just to name a few. They announced that they will be withholding funds normally transferred to Hockey Canada, a portion of the $3 registration fees collected per player. The Hockey Canada scandal reveals that sports culture is not isolated from public or corporate pressures that have been occurring outside hockey regarding diversity in leadership, as well as response to sexual violence. Saint-Onge seems to draw a parallel of Hockey Canada's leadership to governmental leadership, saying in an interview, "I strongly believe that if you take, for example, my government, if there weren't diverse people around the table, maybe there wouldn't have been a ban on conversion therapy this year." So, to make change and to make sure that an organization is connected with the society that they're supposed to be part of, it needs to reflect the society that they're in. These are her words in an interview with Sportsnet. You've been listening to Movements, a broadcast where we talk about colonialism, democracy, and foreign affairs. Some weeks we cover all these topics and others just one or two, but in every we relate it back to the Eastern Townships. Music you heard earlier in the broadcast include Shervi Hajipour's song Baraye, which has become an unofficial national anthem for Iran's protesters. Shervi was arrested after its release. The lyrics are composed of tweets by Iranian protesters about what they are fighting for. Baraye means for the sake of in Persian. Another song earlier was Beds Are Burning by Australian band Midnight Oil, criticizing the removal of Indigenous Australians from their lands to make way for agriculture and mining.